This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Senator Mike Lee has served as one of Utah's two U.S. senators since 2010. In his campaign for the Senate in 2009, Lee found strong support from conservative Tea Party voters who helped him to successfully unseat 18-year incumbent Republican Senator Bob Bennett. Lee studied political science at Brigham Young University and graduated from BYU's law school in 1997. He later served as law clerk to Judge Dee Benson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Utah, and later under now Supreme Court Justice Judge Samuel Alito Jr. on the Third Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Mike Lee has also worked as a constitutional lawyer in Utah and Washington, D.C. Senator Lee was seen as one of the Tea Party instigators behind last year's federal government shutdown. Although Lee is treated like a celebrity by some conservative activists, he is also criticized by both fellow Republicans and Democrats in Washington. Senator Lee spoke last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah to an audience of students and community members on January 10th, 2014.
I've been in the Senate now for about 3 years, and it's been an interesting ride for me and my family. Speaking of my family, I need to mention that I've got my mother-in-law, Carol Burr, with me here today. She lives here in Salt Lake, just a few blocks from here, and so she was kind enough to join me today. And so, you know, you hear people telling mother-in-law jokes. It's not going to happen. Not for me, not today, not ever, because I happen to like my mother-in-law. But I have very much enjoyed the 3 years that I've spent in the Senate so far. When I got to the Senate, I was its youngest member. I'm still the youngest Republican senator, but at the time I arrived, I was 39. I liked to tell people at the time that I was reading at the level of a 40-year-old, even though I was only 39, and I try to keep that up. I'm now 42, and I read at the level of a 43-year-old. I try to stay ahead of the curve, but it might not happen indefinitely. When I got there with a little bit more hair than I now have, it was interesting to see the reaction of the personnel in the Senate, particularly the police. Some of them apparently didn't think I looked like a senator. This is an institution where the average age is about 160. And each time that I entered the Senate chamber to cast a vote, I found myself in a sort of a precarious position because they would look at me and point in the other direction as if to say the door for the interns is over there. And as a teetotaling kid from Utah, I'll just say I'm not used to getting carded, but I found myself going through this from time to time every time I had to go vote. So each time that would happen, I'll even show you the ID that I would have to produce. This is my Senate ID. It says United States Senator representing Utah, has my name on it. It says expiration January 3rd, 2017. I don't know whether that's when I personally expire or just my term of office. But they would examine the card carefully, making sure the tamper-resistant strip was intact. I wanted to make sure that I hadn't bought it from a fake ID outlet in Georgetown or Salt Lake City. And after they looked at it for a minute, they would look at each other and sort of shrug as if to say, well, I guess we have to let them in. And this little ritual would go on basically every time I had to cast a vote for the first few weeks I was there. Until someone, a good friend, finally pointed out that the little lapel pin that they gave me when I was sworn in and that I had promptly put in my desk drawer was actually there to help identify me as a senator to the Capitol Hill police. Over time, I came to calling this my sorry senator pin because when I get carded, I point to the pin and the police promptly respond with something like, sorry, senator, you can come on in. And it works well most of the time. It works pretty much like a charm. It keeps me from getting carded most of the time. Every once in a while, there's a snafu, and it doesn't work as well. One time after I had been there almost a year, I was on the Senate floor. I had already cast a vote. I was waiting to cast a couple of more votes. You see, most of our votes in the Senate are cast by roll call, and each vote takes 15 or 20 minutes to complete. And I was standing at my desk in between votes, waiting for the next one to commence, considering how the next vote was going to go, and one of the non-uniformed security personnel came up to me and said in a fairly brusque tone of voice, excuse me, sir, but will you please not lean on the senator's desk? I found it a little bit odd that he said the senator's desk and not, you know, your desk or this desk. But, you know, I respond well to authority. I immediately stood up and I said, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't realize I was putting any weight on the desk. It will not happen again. They're really kind of squeamish about these desks. You see, a lot of them are original equipment. A lot of them are about 200 years old, almost as old as some of my colleagues. And I said, look, I will not put any weight on my desk. It won't happen again. And then he said, are you with the minority? And I said, well, what do you mean? On this vote or the next? I don't always vote with my party. I guess maybe I usually do, but sometimes they get it wrong. And he said, no, are you with the minority leader? And I said, well, I support Mitch McConnell. He's our leader. What do you mean by that? And he said, no, are you part of the minority leader's staff? Only then did I realize that he doesn't recognize me. So I pointed to the sorry senator pin, thinking that this would be the end of it. Blank stare. Didn't make a bit of difference. And so I thought, well, this is going to be awkward. I don't like to use my title. I'm not accustomed to doing it. I'm still not. But I said kind of in a mumbled voice, I'm Senator Lee. And he said, what? And I said, okay, my name is Mike Lee. I represent a state called Utah. It's sort of squarish. It resembles a chair. It's in the Rocky Mountains. And at that point, he understood what was happening. He saw the pin and realized what it meant, and he said in one hurried breath as the color drained from his face, I'm terribly sorry. My name is Steve, if you want to report me. And then he ran for the door. I felt bad for Steve. I didn't want him to knock himself out over this. I didn't want him to beat himself up over it, so I chased after him, but he was too fast. So now, every time I pass Steve in the hall, I wave to him and I say, hi, Steve, just so he knows that there are no hard feelings. And I understand this is a common mistake that could happen to anyone. But only recently did it occur to me. His name's not Steve. It's probably Bob, and Steve's a guy he works with that he hates. But, you know, that day, through that experience, I was taught an important object lesson, a painful and time-consuming one, but an interesting one, in that I had to assert my right to be there. Had I not asserted my right to be there that day, as awkward as it was to have to use my title, which I was not and still not am not entirely accustomed to doing, I might have found myself getting hauled off in handcuffs. And some of my colleagues would have been a little bit amused watching this happen, maybe would have waited just a few minutes before telling him that it was okay for me to be there. And had I done that, I would have not been able to vote that day. Had I not asserted my right to be there, I wouldn't have been able to vote, and the people of Utah would not have had two senators in the chamber that day. But this sort of lesson applies to all of us in a broader sense, in that there are rights that we have to assert on our own, that we must assert. And if they remain unasserted, will sometimes dwindle. Sometimes they will fall behind. Sometimes we will find that those rights will become less meaningful. One of the rights that we need to assert, that sometimes we're not as inclined to assert as we should be, is the right to have good government, to have the kind of government, whether at the national level, at the local level, or otherwise, that we want, that we deserve, that we think would most inure to our safety, to our happiness, and to our overall well-being. So today, I'd like to share with you some of my vision about where we are as a nation, and more importantly, share a vision of what it is that I think we need to do in order to restore the greatness of what I regard to be the greatest civilization the world has ever known. In order to move along with me in this course forward, I invite you to join me on a journey back, back to 1793, to a time when a group of then British subjects boarded a ship in Boston Harbor, and in symbolic protest against the kind of national government they did not want, a national government not based in Washington, D.C., because no such thing existed then, but based in London, they cast some crates of English tea overboard in a symbolic gesture intended to send a strong signal that the kind of government we were getting from London was not what we wanted. And, you know, at the time, King George III was not overwhelmingly popular in America. And this gesture in 1773 was part of that, this gesture that today we refer to as the Boston Tea Party. Although today what we see is a national government headed by a Congress with a nationwide approval rating that, depending on who you listen to, varies from 6% at the low end to 9% at the high end. We're talking single digits, which makes us as an institution slightly less popular than Raul Castro and only slightly more popular than the influenza virus. But I note that the virus is gaining. So, back to Boston. In Boston, you had this outcry against the kind of national government we did not want. It turned out to be a pretty big deal. It turned out to set in motion a sequence of events that would lead to our Declaration of Independence and later to our actual independence. But they had to stop at some point. They had to move beyond at some point, merely protesting against the kind of government they did not want and move forward to embrace and outline and explain the kind of government that they did want at the national level. It took them 14 years to take this journey from Boston in 1773 to get to Philadelphia in 1787, where they identified the kind of national government that they did want. And they put that in paper, and they put that in law, and they made it their quest to put together that very kind of government that they did want. We have to always remember that our inner Boston needs to remain present. We need to stand ready, willing, and able to stand up to the kind of national government we don't want. But we also have to stay in touch with our inner Philadelphia, where we identify the kind of government we do want.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour and a talk given last week by U.S. Republican Senator Mike Lee. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Utah's junior U.S. Senator Mike Lee spoke last week at the University of Utah.
Today, I think the kind of government that we do want, left or right, Republican or Democratic, is a government that helps to foster and promote economic opportunity. It is economic opportunity, after all, that has helped make this such a desirable place to live. It's helped make it the kind of place that is not only enjoyable for its own citizens, but also desirable to people from all over the world who want to come here. And there is a simple reason for that. In America, this has always been a place where you could be born poor and where you could die comfortable or well off. America is somewhat unique in the fact that most people who are wealthy in this country can remember a time when their own family was poor. And that was because of economic opportunity. Today, while economic opportunity remains, and remains to a degree that still makes us remarkable above and beyond the overwhelming majority of the world, we find that that economic opportunity society is not perhaps what it once was, certainly not what it could be, what it should be, what it must become, what we would like to make it be. We see this economic opportunity threatened at three different levels. Most importantly, and firstly, we see immobility among the poor. We see a lot of Americans who are struggling to get by, struggling just to provide for their own basic needs, who find it difficult to provide for the needs of themselves and their family members. And you see it threatened, you see that immobility presenting itself and threatening the poor in a way that is kind of new. There are some alarming statistics that have just come out in the last few months. One of them indicates that in, I believe, 34 states plus the District of Columbia, a typical American subsisting on welfare benefits would actually see his or her standard of living go down if that person were to abandon the welfare benefits in favor of a job, an entry-level job, let's say, for example, a secretarial position or a construction job. The problem with this is not, as many would view, the caricature Republican view. It's not that there is a waste of money going on. The problem is that it's sad that our government is creating poverty traps. It's sad that our government is, in many instances, disincentivizing people from enhancing their standard of living. If there's one thing that we know about Americans, and particularly about parents, it's that parents want to avoid risk, risk that could threaten the well-being of their children. And so when parents find themselves in a position in which they can continue to subsist based on welfare benefits or take an entry-level job, it is not unreasonable for them to continue to subsist on welfare benefits, even though that will have the effect of locking them into poverty. You see, without taking that entry-level job, they'll never find themselves eligible for a promotion. Without your first job, you never get your second job. Without your first job, you never get your first promotion or pay raise, or your second promotion or pay raise. And thus, the cycle of poverty continues. And so we see that there is this immobility among the poor, and that's something that we've got to resist against. Within the middle class, we see a certain degree of insecurity. A lot of Americans, most Americans, find themselves in this category, where they're making enough to provide for themselves and their families and for their own basic needs. But each time they find themselves with a little additional income, if they have any additional income at all, no sooner have they received that additional income than they find that a lot of it has been gobbled up by a combination of increasing prices, or sometimes prices that manifest themselves as the product of passed down regulatory costs. Sometimes they see it's just inflation that results from monetary policy. But for whatever reason, we find ourselves in a position which a lot of our middle class find themselves in a position of insecurity. At the top of America's economic ladder, we see a different kind of problem, cronyist privilege, where Congress, or the federal government more broadly, will from time to time dole out various benefits that will assist the rich in becoming richer while keeping the poor in poverty and doing nothing to alleviate the problem of immobility in the middle class. And so that's why we've got to start looking for solutions, affirmative solutions that people of all stripes and backgrounds can get behind. Solutions that are part of this Philadelphia agenda, where we identify the kind of government that we do want. Interestingly, some of our best ideas in Washington end up being bipartisan, but it's some of those very best ideas in Washington that are bipartisan that get the very least amount of press attention. You can argue what the reasons for this are, but the fact remains that there is a fair amount of bipartisanship that occurs there. There are a number of bipartisan efforts that I've been working on to address some of these problems. One of them involves a bill that I'm working on that I've introduced with Senator Dick Durbin, the Democratic whip, fairly liberal senator from Illinois. Senator Durbin and I don't see eye to eye on everything. There are a lot of issues on which we pretty aggressively disagree. But he and I have both come to the conclusion that our federal prison system has something wrong with it. Our federal criminal sentencing program has a problem. That problem relates to the fact that, you know, our current federal prison population is roughly 10 times its size in 1980. Now, it's important to point out that our population has not increased tenfold since 1980, nor can it be said, in my opinion, that the number of crimes actually being committed has increased tenfold since 30 years ago. What has happened is we've seen a certain expansion of the federal government's role in criminal law. We've seen the federalization of criminal law. And we've seen, through minimum mandatory sentences, the average stay in prison extending far beyond where it was 30 years ago. So Dick Durbin and I sat down and we decided to look for solutions to this problem, a problem that disproportionately manifests itself among the poor, a problem that robs neighborhoods and families of citizens and fathers, sometimes mothers as well, but more commonly fathers, sons, brothers. We came up with a bill that would reform our sentencing system so as to expand what's known as the safety valve. I won't bore you with all the details, but the idea is to incorporate some of these common sense reforms into a legislative package that can unite people across the political spectrum and help alleviate some of the problems faced by the poor. Some of the other legislation that I'm working on that is bipartisan in nature deals with some of the problems we face, some of the real threats to our civil liberties that we face from the NSA, from domestic spying programs. I've joined together with some of my Democratic colleagues, including Pat Leahy from Vermont, Ron Wyden from Oregon, and Tom Udall, my second cousin, from New Mexico. Incidentally, I oddly have two second cousins in the United States Senate. They're both Democrats, Tom Udall from New Mexico and Mark Udall from Colorado. There's no explanation for how we all ended up there. I didn't know either of them growing up. It's the product of a genetic defect, I think, that we all ended up in the same place. But I, along with the aforementioned Democratic colleagues, believe that we need to restrict the ability of our federal government to spy on us. And this is an issue that concerns all, rich and poor, young and old, but particularly the young, in part because the young are technology savvy. The young understand many of the consequences in a way that older Americans don't necessarily relate to, in a way that older Americans don't necessarily find as alarming. And so we've run a number of pieces of legislation in order to deal with this. I ran another interesting bill that I'm still pushing quite aggressively with my friend Dianne Feinstein from California that seeks to undo some of the harmful effects of the National Defense Authorization Act that was passed just over 2 years ago that contains a provision purporting to authorize the federal government's indefinite detention of U.S. citizens based on allegations of involvement in terrorist activity. So Senator Feinstein and I have introduced the Due Process Guarantee Act so as to make clear that that when you're dealing with a U.S. citizen detained on U.S. soil, you have certain rights that do not allow the government simply to say this person is a terrorist, and we therefore may detain this person on U.S. soil indefinitely without trial. That is not acceptable.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW and a recording of Republican Senator Mike Lee, who spoke last week at the University of Utah. We'll return in a moment. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Senator Mike Lee was elected to office in 2009 on a wave of Republican Tea Party support. On January 10th, last week, Lee spoke about his experience so far serving as Utah's 16th senator and what he calls his conservative reform agenda.
With respect to this anti-poverty and pro-middle class agenda that I've referred to, I've recently introduced four pieces of legislation that I'd like to describe briefly. Legislation that is part of what I refer to as my conservative reform agenda. The first one is one that I introduced just yesterday, less than 24 hours ago. It's my Higher Education Reform Act. The idea behind the Higher Education Reform Act is to help keep in check the always rising cost of higher education by expanding our existing federal higher education accreditation system. Right now you have something that some have described as a cartel. Cartel may be too strong, but it's a sort of an iron triangle that exists between federal bureaucrats, institutions of higher learning, and those who accredit those institutions of higher learning. They control where Title IV federal dollars go. We're talking about federal higher education assistance. What we want to do is not destroy the existing system. We want to allow that to remain intact so that great schools like the University of Utah can continue to participate. But we want to expand it. We want to give the states an option of establishing their own accrediting institutions so that the states can accredit certain novel, certain courses, types of curriculum that are of relatively recent innovation. For example, what are sometimes known as MOOCs, massive open online courses, ought to be eligible for participation in federal, in Title IV federal subsidies. The idea behind this is to make more higher education options available to more Americans. And as we expand the field, as we increase the number of players in this market, what we will see is that there will be more competition. And whenever you have competition, you have better quality and you have better prices. That will ultimately be better off. That will ultimately be something that will inure to the benefit of all Americans, especially those at the bottom and at the middle of the economic ladder. Because education is, after all, the greatest gateway in our society, in our information society, to economic progress. Next is a transportation reform measure that I've introduced. One of the things that Americans face constantly is the high cost of housing. And housing is oddly related to transportation infrastructure in a way that a lot of people don't think about every single day. A lot of Americans, working moms and dads, have to face a difficult decision when they go to find housing. They can pay more to live in a place that is usually going to be closer to where they work, or they can pay less for their housing, but have to drive, have to spend many, many hours every single week driving to and from their workplace. A lot of this relates to the fact that we don't have adequate transportation infrastructure. And a lot of that deficit in transportation infrastructure, which is in turn driving the high cost of housing, has to do with the fact that too much of our transportation infrastructure money goes through Washington's filter and is made more expensive unnecessarily by Washington. So what I propose to do is take the existing federal gasoline tax of 18.4 cents per gallon and lower that to 3.7 cents per gallon. That 3.7 cents per gallon would remain with the federal government and would go toward maintaining our interstate highway system. But the difference could then be collected by the states. That tax revenue would be collected and spent by the states without having to go through Washington's filter and without having to return to the states, not only skimmed, but supplemented by a huge pile of regulations, regulations that make it harder and more expensive for states to build roads, bridges, mass transit systems, and so forth. This is yet another common sense reform that I think would make life better for all Americans, including and especially the poor and the middle class. I've got another bill that I've recently introduced that relates to a concept known as flex time. Hardworking moms and dads want to be able to see their children. Many of you don't have children yet. Some of you will in a few years, and you will likely want to pursue a career that's interesting, but you also want to spend time with your family, with your children, on the evenings and on weekends. And you'll find that from time to time, things get busy at work. Currently, employees of the government have the option, when things get busy at work, of working more than a typical 8-hour day, say one day working 12 or 13 hours when it gets busy, and then making up that difference, working 4 or 5 hours less later in the week. This is a concept known as flex time. Current federal law prohibits American workers from enjoying the flex time benefit if they are in a non-government employee position. This is wrong, and we've got to extend this to the private sector. My legislation would do that. The fourth piece of legislation I thought I'd outline on this in this reform agenda is one that I call the Family Fairness and Opportunity Tax Reform Act, or FFOTRA. I've never been very good at coming up with acronyms. That's a really ugly one. A member of my staff said, that sounds like the sort of word that I would get in trouble at home for saying. Try it sometime, FFOTRA. This bill deals with some inequities in our tax code that are particularly hard on middle-class working moms and dads. It's known as the parent tax penalty. Let me explain what that is. American moms and dads who work are effectively taxed twice, not once but twice, relative to our senior entitlement programs. They're taxed once when they actually pay their taxes, when they work and they have their taxes withheld, and they're taxed a second time relative to our senior entitlement programs, referring to Social Security and Medicare. Taxed a second time as they incur the substantial costs associated with raising their children. Thank you. Those costs, according to one very modest estimate produced by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, suggest that it takes about $300,000 to raise a child to maturity. That doesn't take into account the cost of education, nor does it take into account the, any lost earnings, lost wages that parents might incur. So parents, when they raise their children, incur substantial expenses in raising them. And it's those children that will be the taxpayers of tomorrow. It's those children who will fund tomorrow's Social Security benefits, tomorrow's Medicare benefits as they're being paid out. You see, because our senior entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, are funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. In other words, if you're working right now and you see your Social Security and your Medicare taxes withheld, those are not going into an account for you, as some have suggested in the past. They instead simply go to fund the programs of today. So today's workers are funding today's retirees. It is today's children who will be funding today's workers when today's workers retire. So the Family Fairness and Opportunity Tax Reform Act attempts, in a very modest way, to offset, at least slightly, this parent tax penalty by creating an additional $2,500 per child tax credit. It also eliminates the marriage tax penalty, and it reduces our current system, which is really complex and which occupies tens of thousands of pages of statutory and regulatory text, to a two-rate system, a system in which most Americans who make enough money to be paying under the current income tax system, anybody who's paying taxes at all, at the bottom end would be paying under a flat rate of 15%, up to $87,850 for a single filer, or twice that for a married couple filing jointly. And then what that means is that most people would be paying at that low rate. Anyone earning above that would pay a marginal rate of roughly twice that amount, subject to two deductions, one for charitable contributions, another one for mortgage interest. So these are four pieces of legislation that I've moved forward in order to help the middle class and help poor Americans and to help restore the opportunity society, the economic opportunity society that has made America great. I'm not finished with this agenda. Later this year, in just the next few months, I'll be moving on with the anti-cronyism prong of this, recognizing that when government acts, sometimes through the tax code, sometimes through our regulatory system, very often what it's doing is it's picking winners and losers. Sometimes it does it actively through subsidies. Sometimes it does it more passively, simply by raising the regulatory cost of compliance in such a way as to exclude outsiders, in such a way that makes it more difficult for you as a potential small or mid-sized business owner to get into a particular market. One way or another, as we move forward, as we march toward Philadelphia, there will be disagreements. And there will be Boston-style moments where it will, of course, be necessary for people at every point along the ideological spectrum to speak out against the kind of government that they don't want, to speak out against their government doing things that they don't like, for example, spying on them or recording their phone calls or at least identifying who they're calling, when they're calling them, who's calling them, and when that's happening. But we have to remember that frustration is not a platform, and anger is not an agenda. In order to get to the kind of government we really do want, we have to identify what kind of government that is. And as we do that, we will move forward from Boston to Philadelphia. As that happens, we as a society will benefit. If we do it right, we will enhance and improve and preserve for future generations the economic opportunity society that we have here in the United States. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. Coming up, Republican Senator from Utah, Mike Lee, answers questions from University of Utah. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Republican Senator Mike Lee spoke last week at the University of Utah and answered questions from students in the audience.
My name is Alexandra Tomasetti. I am a senior here at the University of Utah, graduating in the spring. I just wanted to ask really quick. Yesterday, KUTV News had posted an article about you introducing a bill designed to protect religious organizations that do not support same-sex marriage. As that is a really hot topic, and as we sit in this room today, they are rallying at our state capitol here. I just want to know how you feel about it, maybe a little bit of an outline about it, and how you feel that it doesn't allow for discrimination, as that has been the major criticism of it.
Sure. Thank you very much. Yeah. Alexandra?
Yeah.
I'm happy to answer that question. So I recently introduced in the Senate a bill that is designed to protect religious institutions and religious individuals from any kind of retaliation by the federal government based on their view of what marriage is, based on their own personal view, not based on anything else. The idea behind this in some ways can be traced back to what President Obama said a few months ago when the Supreme Court of the United States issued its ruling in a case called United States versus Windsor in June, in which it invalidated Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act. President Obama said, if I remember his words correctly, look, I don't want to take away the tax-exempt status of any church that doesn't want to perform gay marriages. He said, that's not my objective, and he said, I don't know anybody who has that objective. And so that was kind of the idea behind this, was that we need to protect, first of all, religious institutions so that they don't lose their tax-exempt status, they don't find themselves retaliated against in that context or in any other context relative to their interaction with the federal government. To make that meaningful, it also has to be extended to individuals so that a religious individual doesn't face that kind of retaliation from the government. It does not authorize any kind of discrimination by one individual against another. It doesn't touch that at all. It leaves that alone. So the idea behind that is to protect religious institutions and religious individuals from retaliation by the federal government. Sometimes that can arise in the context of tax status, other times contracting status or employment status. One way or another, we think that we need to put a protective barrier around this. I actually think that regardless of how the gay marriage issue is ultimately resolved, and I think it will certainly be resolved by the Supreme Court of the United States, probably this year, maybe next, this is a way that can allow a lot of people to exhale, can allow a lot of people to take a deep breath. It's a lot of the reason why a lot of religious institutions and persons are concerned about this is that they have the sense that this could result in a loss of their tax-exempt status or some other status under federal law.
Thank you, Senator Lee. My name is Kurt Manwaring, and I'm a political science major here. And I was just curious, you know, as you talked about today, you've been working on quite a lot of bipartisan efforts, but also you have become known, whether justly or not, for the times you've decided to stand your ground on your principles. And the thing I'm curious is, what sort of a litmus test do you use, or what sort of criteria do you judge by to know when you're going to stand by your principles and fight, even if it's unpopular, and when you're going to compromise in order to get things done? In other words, I guess going back to the presentation you just finished, how are you supposed to know if you're in Boston or if you're in Philadelphia?
Very well said, Kurt. I appreciate your asking that question, and especially the very articulate manner in which you expressed it. So let me preface this by saying I get two sets of phone calls in my office from time to time. They don't come in all the time, but they tend to come in more when there is a really hot-button political issue on the table in the Senate. And these two groups of phone calls are diametrically opposed to each other. They're 180 degrees opposite of one another. One set of calls says, compromise, please compromise. Compromise in a box with a fox, in the rain, with on a train, anywhere, everywhere, just compromise. And another set says, don't you dare compromise. If you compromise, we will string you up, we will take you out. compromises of the devil. It was an evil idea planted by the devil himself. It's so evil as to be called evil, as in the fruits of the devil. They really don't like compromise. And it occurs to me when these two polar opposite sets of phone calls come in, that in some respects I sympathize and understand what both are saying, but in a different sense, I think that both calls are perhaps missing the point, which is that compromise itself is not a substantive end. It is an inevitability in any legislative process that involves more than one person. So if your name is Kim Jong-un or Raul Castro and you're a legislative body of one, then it's convenient, no compromise necessary. But in almost any other legislative body where there is more than one person involved, the question is not whether you will compromise, it's where and how. And just as importantly, where you're not willing to compromise it and where it will not happen. There is no easy mathematical formula to identify in advance exactly where you will compromise and where you won't. But I do have, you mentioned the word litmus test, I do have some things that I look at to help me decide, to help sort of confine the discussion as I work through the analysis. One deals with my oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States. I'm not going to vote for something that I think violates the Constitution. No matter how popular it is with my party or how unpopular it is with my party, I'm not going to do it. When I first got to the Senate, one of the votes that I took a few months into office related to medical malpractice reform. Now, I'm a huge fan of medical malpractice reform. I think we need it. I think Utah's done a good job with it. I think we could always use more of it. But there were a group of my Republican colleagues, the overwhelming majority of them, in fact, that ran a piece of federal legislation purporting to preempt state tort law, which is decidedly within the province of the state governments, and to establish a single federal standard for tort law in the medical malpractice liability context. I couldn't vote for it, even though it made the overwhelming majority of my Republican colleagues mad. I may have even been the only Republican not to vote for it that day. But the reason was, constitutionally, that was not our power to exercise. There might be a scenario in which you could have some tort reform at the federal level based on some federal nexus, but it would have to be relatively limited. Most torts, that is, most personal injuries that one person commits against another, are state law, and no amount of ranting and raving on our part is going to change that. It is state law. We don't have the power to do it, and even though the courts might let us get away with it, we still shouldn't do it. So anyway, that's one question, is this constitutional? Another question that I ask relates to how it will impact not only the voters of today, because that's an important part of the analysis, but also the voters of tomorrow. Those who are not yet old enough to vote. In some cases, those who have yet to be born or whose parents have yet to meet. Part of what I'm referring to is the fact that we've accumulated a $17 trillion debt. And a lot of that debt, most, you could argue, will end up being paid or dealt with in one way or another by a whole lot of people who are not yet alive, or at least are not yet old enough to vote. It's a form of taxation without representation. We fought a war over that, we won that war, and we ought to be careful about adding to that $17 trillion in debt at a rate of about $1 trillion a year. You know, it's interesting. The interest that we pay on our debt every year is about $230 billion a year. Now, that's a lot of money. There are people right here in Salt Lake City who do not make $230 billion a year. But that's what we pay in interest every year. As a federal government. It's a lot of money, money that can't go to help shore up Social Security or some other government program or our national defense projects. But that's not the scary part. The scary part is that at the rate that we're accumulating new debt, at a rate approaching $1 trillion a year, all that would have to happen, given our current debt obligations, is for our interest rates, our treasury yield rates, just to return to roughly their historical average. And within a very short period of time, we'll be paying about $1 trillion a year in interest. So that raises the question, where are we going to get that? Some in Washington will say, well, we will raise taxes. Even if you raise the top marginal tax rate to 100%, it's still not going to cover the difference between what we're bringing in then, now, and what we would need to bring in then. We could print more money, but that usually ends in tears. It always ends badly for the poor and for the middle class, who are end up being the first and the most severely affected by just printing more money. We could borrow more money to pay the roughly $800 billion difference between what we're paying now in interest and what we'd be paying just within a few years. But if we do that, what's going to happen to our Treasury yield rate? It'll go up. It'll go way up. And before we know it, we'll be paying $2 or $3 trillion a year in interest. The only other option that really leaves would involve massive, abrupt, draconian, and very painful spending cuts, the likes of which we've never seen, that would make what happened with sequestration look like a Sunday picnic. Who does that hurt? The poor, the middle class, far more than anyone else. I start out with the question of, is this constitutional, regardless of what my party thinks? I then ask the question, what will this do to those who are going to have to pay for it? And what will this do to those who will be affected by it tomorrow? From there, there are an infinite number of circumstances that have to be taken into account in each one. One of which, by the way, is input from constituents, which is why it's helpful to speak to groups like this one and to take letters and phone calls, which we appreciate.
My name is Brianna Kirkbride. I'm a political science major here. You speak a lot about the poor and how you said that there was a choice between staying on welfare or getting your first job to go out into there. How do you feel about the fact that there are millions of people in the country who do have a job but still need welfare because the minimum wage is so low? Do you believe that we need to raise the minimum wage or we need to fix it in other ways?
Okay, excellent point. Short answer to your question is, I don't think raising the minimum wage is the answer, but the problem you've identified is a very serious one. It is a very legitimate one. And our current system creates this arbitrary cutoff. One of the problems that people face in some states, it'll vary according to state, because a lot of welfare benefits that people receive involve federal money, but it also involves some state money. So it'll vary from state to state. But in many cases, you will see an effective marginal income tax rate of 90% that is faced by the poor, perhaps by the working poor or by those who are currently unemployed. That is, if they all of a sudden get a new job, they make a little bit more, or they go from not having a job to making a job. When you measure out the difference in their standard of living, when you measure out what they might be paying in taxes and what they might be losing as a result of getting that job or getting that pay raise, it's like having a 90% tax rate in some circumstance. So we do need to fix that. And the reason I don't think that raising the minimum wage will necessarily do that is that I actually think that has the likelihood of hurting the poor because it makes it more difficult to create that entry-level job. And it provides that much more incentive for more employers to look for ways to cut down on their payroll, to cut down on their number of employees, rather than to expand it. But there are a number of proposals that are out there, one of which was previewed either yesterday or the day before by my colleague Marco Rubio from Florida, that involve reforming the welfare system in such a way that there is not this abrupt cliff, such that if all of a sudden you get a new job, you won't automatically, immediately lose all these benefits that you would lose today.
So that will conclude today's forum. Please join me in thanking the
You've been listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website, and join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. for other forums on local, national, and international issues important to people living in Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW